Okay, welcome to this next lecture on program optimization. Before continuing with the lecture, I might comment on the comments which you gave me. So one criticism was that the lecture starts at too early on some days. Sorry for that. I can't build new rooms, and if rooms are occupied, there is no possibility to start at different times. So sorry for that. There is no hope on improvement on that. And then mostly I got the impression that the majority of you are quite satisfied with the lecture, but there seems always one person who is in a bad mood or is not so happy, and he does not think that I have an interest in the teaching of the teaching success, and that I might not be well prepared and everything. So there's always one person who has a negative comment. So I wonder what has happened there and what this particular single student, I don't know even whether it's always the same, if there is anything which one can do. It's difficult. So that is a problem with the statistics. If the number is so small, then if now some, I may ask this particular person to perhaps kind of say what his problem or her problems are, then he would kind of exhibit herself or himself by for these kind of things, and that kind of is against privacy and protection of personal rights, so it's very difficult to deal with that in so small groups. But I would suggest if you have problems, or if you feel that certain things are not right, the group is small enough so that independent of such kind of evaluations, you might walk up to me or to Stefan and make suggestions or ask. So if you feel that something is too complicated, please step forward and ask. And it's not, it's always that, not asking is a problem, but asking may never. Nobody is blamed for such kind of for further questioning. Okay, so then let's continue with the lecture. So we what did we last time? So we considered that weird problem, or somehow it seemed weird, of not removing redundancy, in that sense that if a certain computation is repeated twice, definitely, then we might remove the second computation and replace it by a lookup. So that was kind of what we did with the available expressions. And now we try to be more ambitious. We also wanted to remove partial redundancies, that is only on some paths a certain computation is repeated, and we wanted to get rid of that as well. And we succeeded to a certain sense, but even there it was not clear to us what really is the impact of this kind of transformation. And then we looked at some seemingly quite unrelated problem, namely the removal of loop invariant code. So this means that this code should not be removed altogether, but it should be moved out of the loop. And actually, in the early days of compiler optimization, people simply have moved it before the loop. And so, in the opinion that if there is a loop, then we can be sure that it will be entered, because otherwise, why should there be a loop? And that means that they thought there is no harm. But in principle, there could be many reasons why one has a loop there, and there could be many illegal executions of the program where this loop is not evaluated, and then this results in incorrect programs derived by optimization from a correct program. And that is something which is clearly not what we want. So the first observation which we did last time was that these while loops are very bad for removal of for moving out loop invariant code. So here this loop invariant code is this B+3, and how can we move that out? There is no place for it. And we cannot put it before, because if the loop is not entered, then it would not be executed. So what we could do is to do loop unrolling. So by unrolling the loop once, then we would have a copy of the loop body, a first iteration, and we then would continue. And this first iteration would only be entered if the whole loop is entered. And then all further iterations would be an ordinary loop. And that... then this loop invariant code, the right place for it would be in the first iteration of the loop body. And that, but that means copying the whole loop body. And that might be, so copy it, so while incorrect code is a very undesirable result of program transformation, code multiplication is also undesirable, because that loop body could be very large. And so our compromise was not to to unroll the loop once, that is to copy the loop body, but instead only to copy the condition of the loop. And that means we have a condition of the loop, a condition. So here is the original conditional branching of the loop. And then instead of, so originally we would then go from here, from the end we would directly jump here to the beginning. So if I make it in red, then it might be easier to see. We might jump directly back to to the start node of the loop, and then repeat the condition. Instead of doing so, we copy the condition from the which guards the whole loop iteration. We copy that to the end of the loop. So this is, we conditionally enter the loop, and then we test the same condition again at the end of the loop. And when that condition now is satisfied, we do not jump here, because that is not needed, but we only jump there to the beginning, back to the beginning of the loop body. So this means that this condition here is only executed before entering the loop, and during iteration of the loop, everything is going on is governed by that condition. So effectively, we have transformed the while loop into a do while loop. Yeah? Okay? So I guess one can write, if you think of it in terms of a programming language. So if we have a while ES, that is transformed in if E, do S. No, I don't think that I need that. Do S while E. While E. Yeah, I think it is like that. I think it's like that. So, and then I can also remove this one. Yeah, so that is kind of the effect. So we see that the body is still available only once, the body of the loop, and but the condition is copied. Okay, so that's kind of the trick. Now, now I claim at least that this kind of helps us. Why? Let's see what it helps us, because then this edge here, so that's kind of the observation. So this edge here is traversed only when the loop is entered for the first time. And then all the further iteration goes on here. And then when the loop is exited, we move here. So in essence, therefore, the end of this edge is a decent place where we might put computations which are executed, which are the same throughout all the evaluations of the loop body. So in here, this case, this B plus 3 could be placed there. And then the Y may simply access this value, the auxiliary variable T introduced for this B plus 3. Okay? So that would be the kind of optimization which we aim at. Now, how can we achieve it? Well, what we could do is we take that, assuming that we have such a do-while loop, we might then start just apply our partial redundancy elimination algorithm. So that means we first compute both the available expressions. So at 3, 4, 5, and 6, I claim B plus 3 is available. It is not available at 7, because 7 is reached by one path where B plus 3 is not computed, and the same, yeah. And it's not available at 2, because that is also reached by one path where it is available, namely this path. But it is also reached by one path where it's not available, namely this path. Okay, so then very busy. Where is this B plus 3 very busy? It is very busy at program point 2, because there we definitely know that on all future executions of the program, B plus 3 will be evaluated. It is not very busy at program point 1, because there is this branch. I should go for the red one. There's this execution which we could take, and then B plus 3 is not available. It's not very busy, and it's also not very busy at 3, 4, 5, 6, because there is this path on which B plus 3 is not very busy. So therefore, B plus 3 is very busy only at program point 2. Okay? You see that? Now, where would we kind of place the computation of B plus 3? The transformation tells us we should place it at every outgoing edge where it is very busy at program point at the end point, and it is not very busy and it is not available or very busy at the start point, and when considering the transformation of the control flow edge also. So this means, let us see at the ingoing edges for B plus for the program point 2. So there is this incoming edge. Now it is B plus 3 is available at program point 6, and since it is there is no update to any to the variable B, so therefore it is also along this edge also available at 2. So this is not an edge where we should place the computation of B plus 3. So that was the wrong edge. Now let's look at that edge. It is not available or very busy at program point 1, and also does not become available along this edge. And therefore, we kind of have to place it at the end of this edge. So this is the edge to be selected, and we place, in fact, the transformation going on is this one. Okay? So we saw, this partial redundancy elimination indeed allowed us to move the loop invariant code B plus 3 out of the loop, given that we have a while loop, a do while loop. Okay. So that is our that is the good news. The bad news though is that this only works if we have do while loops and not if we have if we have while loops. So if we what we could do is we could kind of take the if we are given a high level the program in a high level language. So maybe the program contains such a thing like while constructs. Then we might replace them by the this corresponding high-level construct, and then only go and to the control flow graphs only later. So that would be actually the natural method of choice. We only have to take care what happens with that we correctly transform also jumps inside the statement. So there could be jumps to some label. There could be jumps to, and even this this while construct could be jumped at. So there could be a label here that we have to place to move, and there could be inside there could be breaks and continues. At least if we think of Java, and then we have to deal with that. So we have to know to what does a break mean that we go behind the while loop? What does a break mean in a do while loop? Where do we break to? I guess we break to the end, and that's fine. And what happens with a continue? We go to the end of the body of the statement, and that would be also fine. So in that sense, this break and continue would kind of be naturally transformed in the same way. But if we have if we have jumps, then we must be a little bit more careful. Yeah, if we have jumps. Okay. So now, if we do not have the source program at hand, then that's always a little bit of a nuisance because then we only have a graph, and then detecting loops in graphs and is one might think of that's not so difficult. We go for the for strongly connected components, but then there could be loops nested inside loops, and then. If you have just one strongly connected component, this does not help us very much because we have to compose. Everything is kind of connected with everything, so it's then not clear what is a loop header, and what is a while loop and what is not a while loop. So for that, one thing which might come as a rescue is to have. To consider domination relations. So now that is kind of something which is which is just a control flow property. So we just now look at we consider the control flow graph as a graph and try to identify structure in or to recover structure inside that graph. So how can we do that? So one thing is we could say that U predominates a node V if every path which from program start to V necessarily passes through U. Yeah? So we only may arrive at V if we pass through U. So now think of this situation here, where is it? Here. So we may only arrive inside the loop body if we come through program point one, through the loop head. This is the only way how to reach the loop body in that case. Yeah, here in that situation, it's the same. In that sense, we only may reach that part if through this one, and also we may reach only the remaining parts here through this one. Yeah. So this relation that one, so that in this sense we say one node dominates another if you may reach the other node only by passing through the former. So that's kind of the idea. And this relation, this predomination relation, there's also a post-domination relation, but this predomination relation is reflexive, transitive, and antisymmetric. So reflexive, so every node clearly is predominated by itself, so you may reach U only if you pass through U. Okay, so that's trivial. And it's transitive, so if U predominates V and V predominates W, then clearly U also predominates W. So that's kind of one, this is naturally to understand. And if you may reach V only by passing through U, and you may reach U only by passing through V, then they must be the same. So so that is kind of the, this is the property of this predomination relation. Now we may wonder, how can we compute it? So what we, there's one way. Well, if we, this is a graph algorithm, and so now we may come up with a fancy graph algorithm, and people have done so. But we can also say this is we have to determine for every node the set of its predominators, which is a set. And now this comes to our, now it comes to our mind, the set is an element from a complete lattice, is an element of a complete lattice, so why not applying our fixed point techniques? So that is another method of choice which we could apply. And now we would like, so that means our complete lattice now is sets of nodes. Now what is the ordering? So if I have along one path, I may determine all the nodes in there. They are kind of on that particular path, reaching my particular program point U. And if I have another path, then there are, this may contain consists of another set of nodes. Now, what then do I have to do with all the path reaching, with all the sets of nodes of all the path reaching a program point U? I have to intersect them. If I do the intersection of all these sets, then I get those nodes which are contained in all the paths reaching the program point U, and that is the right thing. So that in this sense, therefore, this from that we draw the conclusion that the ordering which we should put onto our complete lattice is the superset ordering. So that means sets get conceptually larger if the sets are smaller. Yeah. And now what is the effect of a control flow edge? Well, we want to collect along one path, we want to collect simply the sets of nodes occurring in that path. And that means the effect of a control flow edge ending in V takes the set P which one has already accumulated and adds the set V. So it's a very simple transfer, it's a very simple operation, which we do here. And then the set of predominators then is given as, we have to do the intersection of all the contributions for all paths reaching program point V. And we apply, the effect of a path is applied to the set of nodes at program start. And at program start, we have only one node, namely we have a set consisting of just a single node, namely the start node. So therefore, that's what we do here. And what else do we observe? Now we might, so we observe that this kind of operation is a distributive function. So this transformation for every edge is a distributive function for for union as well as for intersection, as we have seen, because it's in this particular format which we have, which has occurred multiple times so far. And from that we conclude that the least solution of the constraint system, if you put up the constraint system and determine the least solution, then yes, indeed, it precisely determines the set of predominators for every program point. So you see now, from with our experience, for to solve that graph problem, we do not have to elaborate for 20 hours or 20 minutes. We have this single slide suffices, and we know everything about that problem and have a solution at hand. So let's see what, stupid example, what the analysis will provide us with. For example, if we have this simple while loop, what happens? So we go through the control flow graph in the ordering which is given by the numbering on to the left. Then we find for program point 0, okay, this we have the set consisting of 0. Proceeding to 1, we get, we have to add the 1. And then whenever we proceed along the line, the set always grows by one more element. And now going to 5, so we take the set at program point 1 and extend it with 5. Now we might go another round, and that another round will not increase will not increase anymore, because so it could decrease perhaps, but there is no in essence we have reached the fixed point already after this single iteration. So if we draw the partial ordering corresponding to this predominator relation, we find that 0 predominates 1, 1 predominates 2, 2 predominates 3, and 3, 4. And clearly, there are also the transitive edges. So 1 also predominates 3, and 1 also predominates 4, and 2 predominates 4, and 1 predominates everything. 0 predominates everything. But I have not drawn these. These are kind of the transitive edges. I have only drawn here the immediate predominators in order not to get such a dense graph, to get such a sparse graph. And that now, but that sparse graph exhibits an interesting feature. And that is, it is a tree. Now you may wonder, here, once again, what we record here is the immediate predominator edges. Yeah? So that the transitive edges are obtained by following paths from upward down. For example, that path here gives a predomination relation between 0 and 3. Okay, so that gives us this tree. And we wonder whether this is accidental or whether that is always, whether the immediate predominator relation, whether it is always a tree. And it turns out, yes, it is always a tree. How can we find, how can we prove that? So we have to, being a tree means that every node has at most one immediate predominator. Yeah, so that's the point. If we have proven that, then it must be a tree. Because if it had, so being not a tree can only mean that you have multiple predominators. Yeah, and then you kind of, so downward you may branch, but upward you kind of always arrive at a single node. So therefore, then that would give us a tree. So now that's the question. That's the point which we have to prove. Yeah, well, if one has at most one predominator, then you could have several sinks. But that is not possible that you have several sources. So if it's a forest, you could have something like that. You could have something like that. But this cannot happen. Why not? Well, because according to our construction, the start point predominates everything. So therefore, there's always a path from, also in the predominator tree, from the start point to every to every other point. So therefore, this is not possible. So okay. So now, why? So and the, accordingly, the only node which has no predominator, no immediate predominator, is the start point of the program. So now let's see. How can we prove that every node has such a unique predominator? So the only point, the only way how, at least I know, I would think how to prove it is, well, we try to construct a contradiction from the negation of the statement of the theorem. So assume, therefore, that we have two distinct nodes which both predominate V. Yeah? Then now assume that if, so these are two nodes, and now we may wonder, is it possible that U1 is a predominator of U2? So that would mean that every path to U2 goes through U1. But then this means that U1, every path to U1, then U1 is not immediate, and that means, so thinking of once again of that control of our node, here is V, here is U2, here is U1, and then every path to U2 goes through U1. So now I may kind of make here such a curly thing here, indicating so that that could be more than one path, and then here more than one edge, and here comes the start point. So that would be the situation, but that would mean that U2 is not an immediate predominator of U1 is not an immediate predominator of U2, because it is not so that every path to V traverses to U and to U1, and afterwards extend a little bit the argument. Now let us look at this particular edge. This means every path from program point V goes through program point U1. Now if this edge here, if there were any path here which would not contain U2, then this would mean that U2 would not predominate V. Yeah, because then I would have at hand path in the control flow graph reaching V which do not contain U2, and accordingly U2 then cannot be a predominator of V. So therefore, this means that in fact the predomination relation of U between U1 and V is established via U2, and that means, means here is nothing. So, but then this would mean that U1 is not an immediate predominator, because afterwards there's still this U2. Yeah? And that means this is not possible. So therefore, it is not possible that this relation holds. And likewise, it's not possible that U2 is a predominator of U1. Consequently, these U1 and U2 must be incomparable. So that's the first thing. So there is this kind of relationship does not hold. Now we have that edge and that edge, and then we have this kind of situation. But that can that cannot be, because they consider now a path from P, which from program start reaching V. So this is now pi. This path is not pi. It's pi. And now, then, since U1 is a predominator of V, there is kind of this path contains U1. So that means we would have we can decompose it into two subpaths. One of them reaching U1, and the other one starting at U1, reaching V. Now, U1 and U2 are incomparable. This means that there is that it is not the case that every path from U1 to V1 contains U2. That means there is a path from U1 to V1 containing U2, and another one which does not contain U2. And likewise, it is not the case that U2 predominates U1. That is, therefore, there's a path not from start point to U1 not containing U2, and another one which contains U2. Now then I have this picture on the left here, and in this picture on the left I can now go in this way. I can go take this one here in the beginning and that one here as a continuation, and I by all together I have constructed a path from program start to reaching V which does not contain U2. It contains U1, but it does not contain U2, and therefore U2 cannot be a predominator of V. And that's a contradiction. Yeah? So that's in the same way I can argue that there might be a path which contains U2 but not U1. So altogether I have constructed a contradiction, and therefore the assumption that there are two immediate predominators of V is not satisfied. Now then, the next observation which we make, now our goal was to detect while loops, and we can do it in such a way that what we observe is that the loop head predominates every node in the body. You can only reach the body through the loop head. That's one thing. And then there is back edges from the exit of the loop body which go back to the loop head. And these can be identified in that sense that you have an edge, there could be multiple such back edges, that each such back edge is identified, so an edge goes from U to V, And then we have that the target, the V dominates the source of the edge. Yeah, and that means whenever we have such a situation, we have a node V which is predominated by U, and then we may so if we have such a back edge here, then we may kind of duplicate. Then we may duplicate the condition at which is or the conditional branching which goes on at V. This one we then may duplicate to the program to a new program point, which we place at. So we duplicate the node V to a new program point here. So that's the new program point with new outgoing edges, and you have to do it in such a way that the positive guard goes to the positive guard here, and the negative goes to the negative. And note that this back edge, there could be several such back edges due to continuous statement. If it jumps to the end of the body, then there would be only one such back edge in the control flow graph. Okay. Okay, so then that means we duplicate the entry check to all back edges, and that means for every back edge we introduce one additional node. And we do no longer jump to the start of the while loop, but to this new node, which kind of introduces an extra check on the loop condition. Okay. And in the example, we would that would be the original control flow graph. Now, what would happen? Then we do the we get the predominator sets. We get the edge from 6 to 1. 6 is predominated by 1, so we have such a back edge, and therefore we would duplicate the node 1 and replace the jumps accordingly. Okay. Now that is this helps for when we want to do this loop rotation for this while loops, but clearly it may not cover all cases, because at least if you graph theoretically, we might have strange situations like this one here. So, and if you use go-tos extensively, all things like that happen. So you see here, it's not so clear how the entry, how the loop is really structured. And therefore, our predominator analysis will not easily recover what's going on. So for example, so we have 0, which predominates everything, then 1 predominates nothing, because this program point 2 can always reached also in some other way. Therefore 1 does not predominate anything, and 2 only predominates 3, and 3 predominates 4, that's it. And there is no possibility to identify any back edge. So there is no back edge, and therefore there is no possibility to do anything rotation, do any kind of rotation. But since we are, it's not so clear for us what that kind of loop means, and therefore we are doomed with that. And then there's also things which are kind of which are common, but can also not be rotated in that way. And that is this kind of loop. What does that mean? So the back edge does not jump to a condition, but before the condition. Now you might say, why should we how can we construct a loop like that? Now in that so this means there is kind of there is some computation going on before the conditional branching takes place. How come? Well, in that sense, so in the way how we have constructed our control flow graphs, we always considered conditions as kind of expressions which are atomically evaluated. But in the practical world of how compilers construct intermediate code, this might not be the case. So it might often be the case that you do some kind of arithmetic calculation. So by means of, because for example you only have three address instructions at hand, and the expression is complicated. So what then would the compiler do? It constructs, it decomposes the evaluation of the expression in a basic block, and then in the end checks whether a certain variable is zero or one, or whether sometimes there is also there are certain status flags which are set by the arithmetic operation, and then you have just a conditional branching on these status flags. So so this situation therefore is not the exception, but it is actually quite common. And then you cannot kind of do the loop rotation in the same way, because the back edge does not go to a loop head, but it goes to a kind of a basic block which kind of has at its exit a kind of a conditional branching. And in this case, the entire block must be copied. So all that must be copied, because you have to redo the evaluation of the expression, and that requires the evaluation of a whole block. Okay, so that is kind of the extended version of that which one might want to have in if one is on a low level intermediate format where expressions are not evaluated in one go, but decomposed into a basic block followed by a conditional branching. Yeah. So in that sense, the method at hand still, therefore, the best method at hand, therefore, is to do the loop rotation as early in your compiling process as possible. And the best what you can do is to do it even on the source code on the syntax level, and not on the control flow level. Okay, is there a question? So then we now, so that was this partial redundancy elimination was kind of a sophisticated version of this removal of repeated, it exploited available expressions. Now one might also think about kind of the corresponding analysis and transformation for life variables. So we removed assignments to dead variables which could be considered as dead code. And in that sense we might also try to remove partially dead code. So that is, look at that particular tiny control flow graph. We have here an assignment to T, and T is used on that in one path, but it is not used on the other path. And assuming that T is not used at program exit, then this means that the assignment express 1 to T is only used along one path, so therefore it is an assignment to a partially dead variable. Yeah. Can we remove such kind of partially dead variables or assignments to partially dead variables? And the answer is yes. If we succeeded kind of to delay computations of to delay the assignment express 1 to t as much as possible. So, for example, if we could kind of delay it until we are inside this branching, then we have moved it out of one path, and therefore it has become it disappears there. So. So now the how can we do it? So let us first assume for simplicity that we have such a definition x equals e, and the x does not occur among the variables of e, and that has the consequence that I may kind of duplicate the expression the assignment without changing the semantics. Otherwise, so think of an increment x equals x plus 1, I may not be allowed to do so. So if I now where can I move this definition to? I can only move it to an edge where E is safe, and that means to an edge where E is either already available or very busy. That means it will be evaluated in the future. And also the definition must also be, it must, whenever X is used later, then this definition must be performed before in order to have the right value for X at hand. So what we therefore do propose is to define kind of a delay analysis, if you like. So we determine we maintain for every program point the set of assignments which can be delayed to that or which are delayed to this program point. So this is the set D. So assume that we are given such a set D of assignments which have already been delayed. And now if you have a knob operation, then clearly this knob does not force us to evaluate, to perform any of the design assignments in D. So therefore, the assignments can be further delayed. So this is this one. And now, if we have a new assignment x equals e, then what we do? We would like to delay that further. So x equals d, e is then simply delayed along that edge. We simply try not to evaluate x equals e in that at that edge, but now from the assignments which have been delayed so far, I remove those which cannot be kind of further delayed. So that these are those which contain other definitions of x, or those which contain definitions of variables which are used in E. This is this use E. So let's see what this use E is. Use E is the set of all assignments of two variables which occur in E. And def X is the set of all definition of all def X is the set of all assignments which are either to X, this is the situation, or which may contain X in the right hand side. Okay, so let's once again let us look here. So here we remove from the arriving definitions all those which may affect the evaluation of the right hand side of X equals E, or may be affected by this assignment in that sense that the X kind of interferes with these definitions, so the X could be on the right or on the left hand side. Okay, and that is this delaying of X equals E we can only do if X is not if X does not occur on the right hand side of the assignment, and otherwise we may not be able to delay X. This is this situation. And now for the remaining edges, it's what else could we do there? So if we have just a memory read, then this means there is no assignment to a variable which could be delayed. But on the other hand, X is redefined, so whenever X is redefined, so therefore all the assignments affected by X must be removed, cannot be further delayed. And every assignment which affects the E, which define variables used in E, can also not be further delayed beyond this memory read. And in a similar way, we may define the effect of writing to memory. There are two expressions to be evaluated. No variable is defined, so everything which affects these two expressions must be removed from D. And likewise, if we have a condition, then everything which is used in that condition must also be removed from D. So by that we kind of and now what is the we can. And what is the order? Once again, what is the ordering in this? So did I say what the ordering is of this lattice? So we have the assignments. So this domain D. Two to the power of the assignments in the program. And the ordering is which? What is the ordering? We can delay along further beyond one program point only things which are delayed on all which can be delayed on all paths. So therefore, it is superset. Okay, that is so. The once is yeah. Yes. So this means, so here's, let us see in this example, this assignment, t equals x plus 1, this assignment arrives here along this ingoing edge to 1. It does not arrive along that edge, because there is in between, there is the x changes its value, so therefore it is not, the x plus 1 is not delayable beyond program point 3, so therefore it does not the second edge, along the second edge the assignment t equals x plus 1 does not arrive, and therefore the There is no possibility to delay this assignment beyond the program point one. Yeah. So that is accordingly, so the partial ordering we have found is the superset one, and at start point there's nothing to be delayed. And then, so that gives us again a constraint system, and therefore for every program point we can determine the set of all assignments which are delayable at that program point. And once again, delayable means that on all incoming edge they have been computed, or they should have been computed, but we have not yet computed them, and they are kind of kept in memory, so we but can further be delayed into the outgoing edges. Okay. And then I also have told you, and I now here I have repeated it, since the X does on the of the left hand side does not occur on the right hand side, so this restriction means that every assignment is repeatable in that sense. A and AA has the same effect. So that now what do we do? We insert extra assignments, and so that the insertions, that the original assignments become assignments to really dead variables. So that is here what we do. So if we have a label, if we have an edge from U to V with some label, then we determine, okay, so at program point U, we have a certain set of variables which we have delayed to program point U. If these cannot be delayed further along this edge, yeah, if they cannot be that is, if they are in the this assignment is in D of U and not preserved by the label, then we have to put it there. Before the label, then comes the label of the edge, and then afterwards there could be assignments which are have been delayed through the label, but cannot be further delayed beyond the program point V. Then we have to produce it there. Yeah. So that at program point V, for example, at program point V, you only have the a certain assignment. So let me kind of try to illustrate with a kind of abstract example what I mean. Assume I have the D of U is A1, A2. If A1 is not preserved by the, and the label here is A3. Yeah, so that could be a decent situation. Now assume that the D of V is just A2. So A3 is not further delayable. So therefore, I kind of have to put this A3. So here I assume that this kind of label is an assign. It's okay. So for example, I have here this A3, and this A3 is added to is perhaps added to the set of delayable instructions if it's an assignment, for example, t equals x plus 1. So that means it might be produced here again. And before that, I said before we had a1, a2, a3. Afterwards, I have a2. Then this a2 is delayed all through the control flow edge and what comes out of it. And here before, we might have to produce this a1. So this means now, in essence, kind of trying to, and now I wipe out the intermediate information, I have A1, A3, and another time, and once more A3 at that control flow edge. And that is and accordingly, the second A3 will be the first A3 will be an assignment to a dead variable. Yeah, because the second one will kind of ultimately produce the value in the variable on the left-hand side. And the same kind of construction is done for a conditional branching. For a conditional branching, there might be assignments which cannot be delayed across the evaluation of the expressions. They must be produced before. And now I see that this X, this is a new node here, so that these are produced before the conditional branching, and then there are on both branches there are assignments which I have delayed across beyond this program point U, inside and kind of pushed into the if-then-else, into both branches, but on depending on what is delayable at program point V1 and V2, we have to produce certain assignments which cannot be pushed further down into the control flow graph. Now, and as we have seen in this little example on the last slide, where the transformation has duplicated, I tried to construct it in such a way, has duplicated the assignment at the control flow edge, then this means that that this transformation is only meaningful if we subsequently eliminate assignments to dead variables. Yeah. So here in this particular situation, we would find that what is delayable here, we find that at program point 1, the assignment t equals x plus 1 is delayable, and at program point 2, that there also t equals x plus 1 is delayable, but at program point 3 it is no longer delayable. And that means we may have to insert this computation t equals x plus 1 here after program point 2 and here at this other control flow edge. Yeah, because it's no longer further, it's not no longer delayable Yes, so it's not delayable there. It's not delayable at program point 4 because the intersection of the two, we have to do the intersection, and it's not delayable on the one side. And therefore, we kind of, now you see here that at program point 4, t is dead. So therefore, this is an assignment to a dead variable. I may try to mark assignments to dead variables. in black. So this is then a assignment to a dead variable, and this is a an assignment to a dead variable, and therefore ultimately one we have removed the computation of t equals the assignment t equals x plus 1 on the original place as well as on that place to the left, and we only have kept it here on that other branch where so by that we have removed an assignment to a partially dead variable. Okay? Yeah, okay, so that in particular we found that all original assignments to variables y, where y does not occur in its right-hand side, that all these assignments become assignments to dead variables. And therefore the original assignments always can be eliminated. Thus, by this, and since they are produced only once, everything which is eliminated is also put into this set of dead variables, these layable assignments, and from that set it is only produced once, and only produced when it is removed from that set. From that one, it can be proven that this transformation again is guaranteed not to deteriorate the efficiency. So whenever we insert something, we also remove something on the same path, and therefore transformation is a good one. It will not kind of make things worse. And the other thing is, what we have seen for partial redundancy elimination, there we have seen that doing the removal once may open new opportunities for further improvements. So therefore it can be this transformation can be repeated and may in each step produce further remove further dead code. So what we see from this this partial redundancy elimination, this partial dead code elimination was not so trivial. So in fact it was I would say rather complicated. The transformation is no longer so so obvious. In some sense intuitively, while partial redundancy elimination tries to execute things as early as possible, and by that making things more redundant, this partial dead code elimination had the opposite strategy. It tried to delay things as much as possible, hoping that by doing it becomes superfluous in the end. But this kind of effect was not achieved in a completely straightforward way. It was kind of, in some sense, so here this last one was achieved by inserting further assignments in such a way that the original assignments can be removed then by one of our standard optimizations, namely this life variable and assignment to dead code, dead variable optimization. And so it was not at all a trivial optimization. And to argue that this optimization is an optimization and it does not destroy the correctness of the program is a non-trivial, requires non-trivial arguments. And we notice, like here, delaying was one preparation step, and then the actual optimization was done by life variables. And so this means there is an intricate interplay between these transformations, which we have already noticed, and we here see once more that the interplay of optimizations is important. And in particular, it means even if we have several optimizations in our toolbox, we might organize them in different ways and may hope to achieve the improvements by them. But the ordering in itself is not completely fixed. So you could do it in different ways, and you might the result will be not necessarily the same. And we also notice that certain optimizations can need to be iterated. So here is kind of a meaningful ordering, which one might want to apply. So the first thing is, so the first step which I suggest would be to kind of try to improve upon the value based on value analysis. So this value analysis would allow to identify parts of the program which are never reached, which can be removed altogether, and by that the program can be shrunk. And specializing constants also, it might simplify the structure of the program by removing certain ifs and elses. So this is the first transformation at hand. And the next thing is then the loop rotation thing. So this loop rotation, one might consider either one does it here, or one could do it also in the very beginning. That could be that one might want to do in the same way. So that is, if one wants to do it completely syntactical, then one should do it as quickly as possible in kind of a normalization of the syntax. Then one should do it at the very first step. But otherwise, one could do it after constant propagation and interval analysis and such. And the next thing is, then one could try to improve these things on available these transformations which we had to improve on the available expressions and the dead variables. And the available expressions, recall, therefore, there we also removed assignments between we optimized this variable assignments, which one might also want to remove in one go. And then one could go for more sophisticated things like partially dead code and partially redundant code, which then these transformations could again be iterated, and these would allow us to also to remove loop invariant code. That is kind of a suggestion. One might also fill in. There are then also various kinds of more specialized transformations which one might want to do, but I guess these are the most important ones. So now, this kind of terminates this type of this class of transformations and optimizations. And so, is there a question? Then we might kind of open up a new avenue to optimizations. And which are slightly more high level, if you like. And to a certain degree now kind of go no longer to the very details, but try to kind of catch a more fundamental idea in the, it's kind of an algorithmic idea, which allows, we would like to exchange one algorithm by another. So to make it, and what is the general approach? how can we replace one algorithm by another? That is clearly, replacing algorithms is always a difficult topic, and in particular, we need kind of a clue how to improve an algorithm. How can we do it? Now, the general idea is, so the general philosophical idea is this one. If we have an expensive operation, we might want to do to replace it by a cheap one having the same effect. So in some sense, this redundancy elimination due to availability of expressions was of the same type. Because what we did was x plus 1, that value is used repeatedly, and so we store it in a variable, and that means later recomputations of that complicated expression are replaced by a lookup. So they are not removed completely, but they are replaced by a lookup. And that's not completely true. So we made it that is, we stored it away so that repeated would not have an effect anymore. No, there are forms of availability of expression optimizations which are more in this type. But here, let us see for other examples what we could. What we could do. So let us see at a very concrete programming problem, namely to determine the value of a polynomial. Now, how expensive is it? So it's a polynomial in one variable, and the polynomial has degree n. How can we evaluate this expression? So clearly it's an expression, and so we can take it literally and try to literally compute it, evaluate it. So that means we would first compute the power of x and multiply it with n, and that costs how much? That costs us n multiplications all together. And then we would compute this monomial, which gives us n minus 1 multiplications, and so on, until in the end we compute this thing, which is costs us 1 multiplication. So we have to, the number of multiplications, therefore, is 1 plus 2 plus 3, and so on, until n. And all the sum, this sums up to a quadratic number of multiplications. And then we add up all these monomials. This gives us n additions. But clearly this is not a very intelligent way of evaluating it. Why? Well, because we compute this the powers of all the x's separately. Which is kind of stupid because x squared I can, well, if I'm given x squared I can produce by multiplying with x. Now the third x to the power of 3 I can obtain once I have kept the x squared just by another multiplication. So altogether, in fact, I only need, I can get all the powers of x by n minus 1 multiplications, and then I multiply all these powers of x's with their coefficients. This gives us another n multiplications. So altogether, I get 2n minus 1 multiplications plus n additions, and that's a little bit much. It's a little bit better. And then there is even one more. So one method of evaluating such functions by reducing the number of multiplications even further down to n using the Horner scheme. So here is the Horner scheme. So I guess all of you have heard about it. How you do it? You just you reorganize your polynomial in such a way that you always start innermost by multiplying x with this highest with its highest component, giving you one multiplication, and adding the next coefficient, and then you take that, the result of that, and again multiply with n with x, and so on, and add then the next coefficient, and so on, and so on. In the end, in the very end, you kind of do a last multiplication with the x and add the lowermost coefficient. So altogether, this amounts to just n multiplications, and you have n addition operations as well. So that is so. By that, one sees that just by rearranging that formula, one can kind of reduce the effort. So that is, in that sense, here, this is a kind of optimization, which does not kind of, so that is doesn't, it's just general optimization, which I find interesting, which does not really fit under this topic, but which now brings us to the next problem, and that is, given, assume that you do not want to evaluate that polynomial just once, but you want to tabulate it for a series of inputs. So then clearly what one could do is one could kind of take the F, even we have now this smart Horner scheme, and then evaluate it for the first x, then for the next x, then for the next x. And that means for every new evaluation, you again have to do n multiplications and n additions. Yeah, that is what one would have to do. In fact, it turns out that there is a cheaper way how to do it, and that is based on differences of polynomials. So here is the polynomial f which we would like to evaluate. This it is a polynomial of degree 3, and we want to evaluate it for 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so forth. Yeah. So here I have in that column I have listed for you the functional values. Now, what can you do? Now, think of what you have learned in analysis. If you take the derivative of f, then it's only a quadratic function. So the degree decreases by one. Now, if you do the second derivative, then it's a linear function. And if you do the third derivative, then you have a constant function. And in fact, it turns out that the same happens for the differences. So if you take if you consider the differences of this function f, so fx minus, put it differently, fx plus 1 minus f of x. So that is a polynomial of degree 2. And that, if you have a quadratic polynomial and again do the differences, then you get a linear function. And if you take the differences there, then you get a constant function. So this means if I, here in this particular case, if I take the differences here, so between these two, it's 2. Between these two, it's 10. Between these two, it's 36. These are these three. So by taking the difference, I end up in this column here. And that is kind of described by a polynomial of degree 2, because f was a polynomial of degree 3. And now if I take the differences there, then I end up in this column here, and that is now a linear function. So therefore, this means, and what is the difference between the two values in this linear functions? It's 18. So now this makes it clear to me, to us now, what would be the next value here? Well, we have to add 18. So 26 plus 18 is, now we have to calculate, I think it is 44. Yeah. And what is the next value in the next column? Okay, so we have to 36, we have to add 44, and this gives us 80. And now what is the next value of F? So then we have to add simply 61 plus 80, which is 141. And now you see suddenly that the next value in this, the evaluation of F for the next X has not taken us any multiplication at all, but only has taken us just as many additions as the degree of the polynomial is. So in that sense here, it means three additions. And that is for every further value, and that clearly what we have, what this therefore allowed us to do, it allowed us to compute after having provided certain initial filling, after having filled this upper triangular. This means that every further evaluation boils down to n, if the polynomial has degree n, to n additions. And by that we have replaced the expensive evaluation of the evaluating the polynomial as is to a cheaper evaluation of this four additions. So that's kind of the flavor of operations we are now after for today. Thank you very much for your attention, and we meet again tomorrow.